probably got cut off.
Well, when
should be treated or
yeah, whether right, whether or not a particular infant should be treated or be allowed to die, and frequently the physician might say continued treatment of this infant is futile, and not only is it futile, it's imposing an enormous burden on this little infant, and one or the other parents or a grandparent or someone may say, well, you know, let you know, I believe in miracles, or let's keep treating. And that'd be all of this kind of conflict, not unlike the conflict in adult ICUs, where one person would say, keep Grandpa on a ventilator and keep him going, you know, maybe he'll recover, and others saying, this is nonsense, he's not going to recover. At any rate, so the hospital started to develop ethics committees, beginning with the newborn nursery because of the baby Doe concern, and I can get those dates for you later. It was around 1983 or 4. It was after I'd returned from my sabbatical. Celia and I have often said, just parenthetically, Celia and I have often said that it was very fortuitous that I took a ethics sabbatical
that time,
because there were very few in the country.
Everything was starting to happen.
Right. And there was the only place you could go, and there were very few physicians with any kind of training. So then everything started to happen, as you say, 83, 84, 85 was baby Doe and all the rest of these things. So then I helped with the three hospitals get started, their ethics committee, and then I also began to give lectures.
Three
and
hospitals?
St. Mary's, Washoe, VA.
Oh, VA as well?
Oh, yes, the VA. Yeah, they were one of the first ones to establish an ethics committee. Actually, I think it was mandated by their central office, and they've had one for as long as the other two hospitals, or even longer. Paul Jensen was the one who started that one. Sister Damien over at...
Peter Damien. Yeah.
And then over at Washoe, I've forgotten who was responsible. Well, it might have been Whitey Ingeseth, the minister.
Yeah.
And I think he was very influential in getting that. Anyway, I helped them start that. And then the last thing, and then I'll stop on this. I also then began to make rounds with the medicine residents here, mostly at the VA, sometimes at Washoe. And there, rather than talking about paper cases, we'd literally talk about patients right now in the hospital with one problem or another. And
well, how did the ethics committee actually function? There was a chairman of it, and so many physicians were on it. Did you read
No, it was
cases?
Very. It wasn't a lot of physicians. It was there was a chairman, usually appointed by the
chief of staff, or at
St. Mary's appointed by Sister Pedia Damien, and at the VA appointed by the chief of the hospital. So at Washoe, I think it was by the chief of staff. So it was varying ways, but it was set up to be not dominated by physicians. There are usually a couple of physicians, usually those who were involved with dying patients in the coronary care unit, the ICU, the dialysis unit, so they were involved with that. Usually several nurses, often from the nursery and from the ICU. Often a chaplain, a minister, and it's St. Mary's, a priest or a nun. Then often there would be a social worker. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of so-called public members who had no...
Laymen
who had no, and women who had no particular involvement in the hospital per se. And the idea was that if a physician or a nurse, usually those were the two, or a family member had a severe problem with how a particular specific patient was being treated or not being treated, they could call the chair of the ethics committee and say, I would like the consultation from the ethics committee to help work out the problem. Now, oftentimes the problems were not ethical or moral. They really were communication problems. The patient or the family or the loved one or the nurse or the physician were all talking at cross purposes and not really communicating well. And I'd spent a number of ethics committee meetings, and even afterwards when I was asked as a consultant to sit down with the family and the physician to work out the communication so that everybody understood what the problem was and what were some of the solutions. And when that process took place, usually the so-called ethical or moral issue evaporated. There was no moral or ethical issue. It was essentially these people are not talking with one another and not understanding the words they were using. You know, physicians can use a lot of jargon, families can use a lot of emotional words, nurses can also use jargon, and people are talking past one another instead of... So, oftentimes what the Ethics Committee did was sort of help in the communication process, and I must say, for the record, I don't recall ever the Ethics Committee ever making a decision. The ultimate decision in a hospital setting is always rests with the physician and the patient. And as I said earlier, the physician who can't resolve the issue with the patient can always withdraw from the case, and a family member, or excuse me, the patient or a guardian can always discharge a physician and say, I want someone else put on the case. So, but the committee was mostly there to help clarify what were the ethical issues, what were the communication issues, what were the economic, social, other cultural issues, and how can we help the physician and the patient or the family resolve it?
So it wasn't a sanctioning committee?
No, it had no authority. No authority. Was
no
always
review of records and saying this should have been done and
no,
wasn't.
No, no. There would be some of that, but only if the physician asked. And we did do a few retrospective evaluations after the patient died. Mm-hmm. The physician would come and say, you know, this is what happened. What can I learn from this? So yes, there was some of that. The other role of the Ethics Committee was some public education, but mostly professional education. So we put on at all three hospitals, and I participated as a faculty member in a number of those, would put on conferences for nurses and doctors in the hospital discussing these very ethical issues, which were then now, of course, being highly publicized long before society started talking about, publicly talking about assisted suicide, and long before Kevorkian came along. So this all began in the 1984 and up to about 1996 when I retired, 1997 I guess. I did a lot of ethics consultation, ethics conferences statewide. I talked in all the hospitals. And of course, the big part of my ethics life, if you will, was the publication of our book, Playing God, in 1998.
That was almost a direct result of the Hastings year, wasn't it?
1988, excuse me, I misquoted. The book was published in 1988. The book Playing God by Simon and Schuster was the direct effect of going to Hastings. Mm-hmm. And the reason, and I think I may be repeating myself, but very briefly for the record, Celia would often go to the Hastings Center to conferences. I was going there every day to work. But usually once every week or once every 2 weeks, there'd be a conference, a two-day conference, you know, Thursday, Friday, or Friday, Saturday. Celia was, as other spouses, were frequently invited to come and sit in. And we would rummage through the library, and it became very apparent that all the books that we saw and most of those journals were written for the professional and by professionals with a lot of professional, philosophical, ethical jargon. So it was Celia's idea, actually, that maybe there was a time coming up, because this was hitting the newspapers. It was on the Phil Donahue show about surrogate motherhood. Baby Doe was all over the New York Times.
Kevorkian.
Karen Quinlan case was in the newspapers, all of those. All of these different cases. Celia said maybe there's room for a book that would discuss these issues in layman's terms, in simple, well-written, journalistic style. And so we talked to several people at the Hastings Center. Art Kaplan was my mentor, along with Dan Callahan. Art is now the head of professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Anyway, he said, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you see what you can do? So the last couple of months we were there, we worked on an outline every night at home and reviewed it with them, and then finally, since Celia had already published a book, or was in the process of publishing a book on health writing, which has been published, and had an agent, we had lunch with our agent in New York shortly before coming home in June of 1983, gave him this proposal, and he went around over the next year and Finally got a editor at, which I'll tell you about, an editor at Simon & Schuster, who said, yeah, I think this book is timely, and we will, if they will write a sample chapter and a sample chapter and a fairly detailed outline and let us see it, we will consider letting a contract. Well, as it turned out, our editor, Bob Bender, had just gone through this problem with his grandfather. He had just been through a very difficult period, and I don't think I'm violating his privacy, and I don't know all the details, but they had gone through a very difficult ethical issue in the care of, I think it was his grandfather. And so he was attuned as an editor at Simon & Schuster that this was becoming front page stuff.
Good timing.
So in 1985, I can check our records, 1985, Simon & Schuster gave us a contract with an advance, gave us a year to write the book, and it was during that year, as I suggested earlier, probably 85, 86, that I would work part-time at Special Children's Clinic and work at home part-time writing the book. So Celia and I would, literally for that year, we wrote that book in a year, and it was from, I'm guessing, I'll look it up, I think it was the year 1985, 86, because we didn't start doing serious writing until we had a contract. The one thing you never do is write the book without a contract. All you do is spend a lot of time and end up with a 500-page manuscript in your drawer. So once we got the contract, we got serious about it and wrote the book.
That's been rewarding for you?
Oh, wonderful. That was a great experience. I mean the
end result of that. It's been well accepted, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, and yeah. It sold very well.
And it's in what printing now?
The paperback is in its second printing.
And
it was a good experience, and it was a wonderful experience for Celia and I, because what we had to do is we had to sit down and discuss and argue these issues between ourselves before we could put on paper what we were going to say.
A good combination, because you have a medical and a layman.
Writer. And she could put it in good, she could write the stories, because we interviewed lots of people. We interviewed hundreds of people who have told their stories, many of them anonymously.
That's what makes it readable, by the way.
Yeah, it is. It's the human interest stories.
Yeah.
But we had, and as we say in our foreword, we tried to use one voice so that the voice was one. But in order to get a single voice for the reader, Celia and I would have to discuss it. So we then, for the first time verbally, began to discuss issues which we had sort of unconsciously accepted, and unconsciously, even from our childhood and our similar upbringing and our religious education, had sort of assumed that we had never actually written on paper why we believe this as opposed to that, and what would be our attitude for someone who disagreed with us. So it became a very interesting experience of writing the book, and literally, and of course I think I may have told you the story about Rosalind Carter and Jimmy Carter. Okay, then Jimmy Carter and Rosalind had just were in the process of writing or just published one of their first books, and he said, and she said on Phil Donahue or some show, and had written in one of the women's magazines, it almost led to their divorce because they made a classic error of collaboration. He'd write a chapter, she'd write a chapter, they'd give them to the other person, and they would criticize. Well, first of all, they had two voices, hers and his. Secondly, one would be criticizing what the other had written. And that became a very difficult thing. Once you put your words on paper and someone criticizes, and you've got some pride of authorship and invested in that. And so their advice was, if you're going to collaborate with anyone, truly collaborate, you should discuss all of this and put it on a piece of paper so that it's your joint agreed opinion on an issue before it ever sees paper. So Celia and I would, each of the days we wrote, 3 or 4 days a week we'd write, a couple of days I'd go to work. We'd write. The next day when I was at Special Children's Clinic seeing patients, she would type it up on her computer, would come home that night, she'd print off the two or three pages she had done, and we'd sit there with a cocktail, and I'd read it out loud, or she'd read it out loud, and we'd both of us say, oh, no, that sounds terrible. That's not what we wanted to say. Oh, no, that's terrible. So the next day, we'd edit it and change it. But we weren't, I wasn't criticizing what she wrote, and she wasn't criticizing what I wrote. We simultaneously, I guess, were criticizing together, and we both realized, as because we read their transcripts out loud, because when you read out loud, you know, you stumble over words that sound, that are too long and don't work. Anyway, that's how we actually wrote that book.
Did you find have any surprises between the two of you, you being a doctor who'd been in the field? And
not really,
no,
not really.
You're
pretty much had similar views, yeah. Pretty much had similar views. I always acquiesced to her in the way she told the story. And she usually acquiesced to me when it was a medical issue. Mm-hmm. But combined, the ethical issues are not medical. You know, ethical issues are not medical. They're the moral community dealing with a problem. The physicians only have one piece of the ethical puzzle, as do nurses and the patient and everybody else. That's what makes it so fascinating. It's traditionally, of course, physicians always thought, you know, paternalistically, they had the answer. Well, they don't, as we know. They have the scientific issues, and they also have what may be the best scientific approach to an issue, but it may not be the most ethical approach. So we generally came to agreement on how we would express the ethical issues, and that's the way we did it. Last part about playing God, but interrupt any time, was I think I may have told you when I was in the hospital, I got my transplant in June. We had already finished the book. We had sent the book in to the editor in early 87, late 86. And he then spent, well, the next 3 or 4 months, they kept sending back Celia and he, because it was that point, it was editing. We weren't going to change basically the substance of the book. So in the spring of 87, we were sending back a piece of the manuscript. And I have the original manuscript I can show you later with all of his editing notes on it. And then she would edit them on the computer and send them back. Well, finally, he knew I was going down to San Francisco to get a kidney transplant, and this is June of 87. And while I'm recuperating, he sent us the galleys. They were all ready to go. And so in those couple of weeks, sitting around a hospital bored to tears, Celia and I got them to give us a small little conference room quietly. And we would go in there and we'd read the galleys. I'd read for a couple of pages and she'd edit, because we had two copies. And then she'd read and I'd edit. So. And the reason we read out loud, again, at the galleys, was to be sure that we hadn't stumbled over words. And basically, the galleys were pretty good. We didn't make many complaints. But then we sent the galleys back. And that would be in about August of 87. And we didn't hear from Bob, the editor. We didn't hear for several months. Did I tell you this story? You remember this one? I think this is in there. Well, I won't elaborate any longer.
No, but that's all right. Go ahead.
But basically, we didn't hear, so finally Celia called, and Tom's home recuprating. I'm on sick leave, 3 or 4 months, whatever it was. I wasn't ready to go back to Special Children's Clinic. Well, I didn't. I never went back there. Once I got the transplant, then I just simply stayed teaching full-time and administering. I'll tell you that in a minute. Anyway, so finally Celia called. She said, well, we've been holding up the release date. We couldn't get it out for the fall list, which would sell at Christmas time, which is their original goal. And the reason is we wanted to be sure that Tom would survive and live so he could go on a book tour. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't that bad, because instead of putting a late...
Dead authors don't sell.
Right. Dead authors don't sell. So instead of having the 87 release date for the fall book list for Christmas, it came out in the spring book list. It has a 1988 date on it. And they said, fine, it'll be published this spring. And then I have a list if you're interested. I was on maybe 100 or so radio and TV shows, including Larry King and some others, talking about the book when it was first released. And
that, I would like to know who you were interviewed by and how the book was distributed.
Okay. So in 1988, it came out in January or February, or the fall, it was in the winter, and that was the publishing date. And then I went on a book tour. Celia and I went to Washington, we went to New York, we went to Pittsburgh. Well, we went all over the place and did a book tour, mostly talk shows. And then I did a lot of talk shows from my office and from home.
Oh.
Radio talk shows, because you don't have to be any, you can talk on radio any place.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of radio talk shows from here, and I did radio talk shows from my office. Someone would call in. Some of them would be live. Some of them would be, and I've got some of those on tape if you want to see them someday. Radio talk shows live, and some of them be recorded. And someone would say, Dr. Scully, I have your book in front of me, and my audience here in Des Moines, Iowa, and we'd like to ask you, you know, why you wrote this book, why'd you call it Playing God, and what do you think about, and they'd always ask you some ethical issue trying to get you on the spot. Or what do you think about, you know, Karen Quinlan, or what do you think about making babies in Petri dishes, you know. So, you know, you try to give a fairly non-committal answer. So that was in the spring of 1988. I'm keeping some notes here too, so.
Okay.
Anyway, that was the spring of 1988. And in the meantime, I'm putting together ethics curriculum, I'm teaching ethics and all that sort of stuff. And
your health is good by this time.
Well, once the transplant was over, I think I came back to work. In about 3 months, the transplant was June, I had to be operated on the second time because the first surgery went well. But after a couple of weeks, there was a kink in the artery that they used to hook up the new kidney, the renal artery. So they had to go back in. So I actually was operated on twice. And so after the second surgery, which was in early August of 87, I stayed on sick leave about 3 months. Remember, I had been working at the medical school since 1971 or two. And so I had a lot of sick leave. And I think I went back to work around October, middle of October of 1987. But I did not return to Special Children. I did not go back to Sierra Developmental Center. That was finished. All I did from that point on was to teach pediatrics and ethics. And to finish that thought, one day in late October, Bob Daugherty met Celia down at Raley's where they were shopping and said, how's Tom doing? And Celia said, oh, he's fine. He's recuperating and planning to come back to work pretty soon. So he said, I'd like to come over and visit with him and see how he's doing. So Celia said, sure, come on over. So he came over the next day and said, I think it was a Saturday morning. He said, I've got a job for you. I said, sure, I'm looking for a job. I'm not going to Special Children. Sort of work part-time. He said, well, I'd like you to be dean of students. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, Dr. Miller, Grant Miller, who I appointed in that job, I appointed Grant when I was the dean in 1979 or 78 to be the dean of students. He decided he wanted to get out of that job, but also at the time, Grant Miller was going to start working on the psychiatry residency program, and he didn't want to put all the time in. And dean of students was a lot of work, as he did. And so then I took over as the dean of students in the fall, late fall. It was around Thanksgiving of 1987, just after I recuprated from my transplant.
Yes, I remember that.
And I did that for about 3 years until I had a heart attack. I had a heart attack in the fall of 1989. Actually, it was at Thanksgiving. I was in St. Mary's Hospital in their ICU. And
in 1989?
Yeah, I got the dates. Actually, I was there for Thanksgiving because I remember Celia and Leslie and her husband, who at that time was a boyfriend, came over with several of my other children, came over on Thanksgiving evening and brought me a fresh, hot Thanksgiving turkey dinner, because I wasn't able to be here and I was already 4 or 5 days doing fine.
Now, what was this heart attack, or is this a personal thing?
No. No, I don't mind doing that, no.
What was it, a coronary occlusion?
Yeah, I had an occlusion, probably because when I had my, to go back for a moment, when I had my kidney transplant in 1987, the surgeon said your blood vessels are those of a young person. You have very clean, because they had done arteriograms and they actually look at your blood vessel while they're in there. Said you have very, very clear, and I remember it vividly. He said you have very clean blood vessels. You don't have much atherosclerosis at all. Well, I was 40. Let's see, I was 50. I was 55 at the time when I had the kidney transplant, and later Larry Noble, who did the coronary angiogram, said no, the vessels look fine, but I had developed a clot. Probably, we'll never know for sure, but he thinks, and I do too, probably because of the medication I was on to prevent rejection. Since the day I got a kidney transplant, I've taken Imuran and prednisone and a number of drugs to both prevent rejection, which wasn't very likely because my sister and I had very good, not perfect, we're not twins, but we had a very good genetic match. But they think probably it related to those drugs, and since that time I've been on Coumadin, and I've seen him regularly, and I've done all sorts of treadmills and that.
Did you have surgery at the time of that heart attack?
No bypass. They just went in and reamed out the vessel, and the clot dissolved. And as I say, the blood vessels themselves look pretty good. And the other vessels in my heart looked good, and so it was one of those probably due to medicine rather than to some inherent vascular disease, according to the cardiologist, and that's been, of course, 8 or 9 years ago.
Did you change your diet after that?
Yes,
You're
going to
be finished pretty soon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you
got to
get going.
Yeah. We're just finished.
Okay.
We're finished.
Let me just stop the...
So anyway, that was that, and I was hospitalized, and then that next spring, which would be the spring of 90, Bob and I had been talking, and I said, I don't need any more stress of students being dean of students. And so I got out of that job. Bob appointed Jerry May, and at that time he asked me, would I take over and start an alumni office and be the associate dean for alumni affairs and start an alumni program, which I did, and so we can stop right there.
Okay.
So that's the spring of 90.
Now, one of the things, and I'll put it on this tape so that we will get back to it, I had some questions that I wanted to ask you about at the Special Children's Clinic from the early days until you stopped working there.
Right.
The type of a few more case stories.
I've got a bunch of those. Yeah, I've got a bunch of those. Sure. You got this turned off?
No, I have it on now because I don't want to get Mr. DeCibio's first name.
Oh.
Do you remember?
I haven't the slightest idea, but I can look it up.
Okay.
I've got it written down someplace.
You'll look it up for me then.
I don't know.
Okay.
We
might as well have the whole thing.
Yeah, a young Italian fellow from New Jersey.
Okay, we'll end here then.
Okay.